You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
I welcome Robert Sutton back to the podcast. Bob is an organizational psychologist and a best-selling author. He has served on the Stanford faculty since 1983. He has written many books, including the best-selling No Asshole Rule. His latest book, co-written with Huggy Rao, is called The Friction Project. You're going to love this podcast. The book's great. He's a great interview. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Bob Sutton, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's great to see you again and hang out with you, Kelly. It's always such a joy.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you. And actually, I have a good way, I think, of starting this conversation. And it's the way you actually start the book. I want us both to tell a friction story in our places of business, and I've got a pretty good one. but let's start with yours, because this starts with an email and a Word attachment that popped up in your inbox when you were at Stanford, right?
Oh, yeah. So one morning, I'm sitting there, you know, trying to get the day started, and from somebody who's very senior, probably the third most powerful administrator at Stanford, an email comes into my email box at Huggy. We both got the same email, Huggy, my co-author, 1,266 words long. And I was in the process of editing, and I was like, this could have been 400 words really easy. There was all these picky, like this person was anticipating arguments as opposed to, and then it had a 7,500 word attachment, and it invited every Stanford faculty member to devote a Saturday to doing like a mass brainstorm about the new sustainability school at Stanford. And I love the new sustainability school and the idea behind it. But it just, to me, showed complete ignorance, honestly, of what we call in the book the cone of friction, that when you're in a leadership position, and you should start multiplying the impact of the actions you take on other people. And I didn't make much progress with her, but there's a couple other university administrators I would write notes about, and I would send back edited emails, and they got better. Because, you know, during the pandemic, everything was virtual. So that was one of the ways when I was working on the book, I would procrastinate by annoying people with my comments about their writing. And gee, can't we meet every other week?
I'm never sending anything to you that's over like three sentences.
You're not in my chain of command, so I'll leave you alone.
Okay, good. All right, well, let me tell you my story, because that fits into the friction theme. So a friend of mine wanted to buy 22 tickets to a show on Saturday night, the Saturday night at Second City. And she reached out to me this last Monday. We're recording this on a Friday. I told her to call the box office, and the box office told her she needed to call a different department. She left a message and no one called her back that night. So I got curious and emailed her Tuesday morning to see if anyone had called her back, and no one had. And this is now at 11 a.m. She called the box office again. They said all they could do was send her to this other phone number. I want to, like, having now researched this, none of this is the fault of Second City employees. If any of you are listening, you're all fantastic. It's the system. It is a gunky friction system. Yep. And when it got worse when people tried to tell me why this was happening, because someone was on break And the other person who this fell to was a kind of a senior person who in no way was going to be able to process all these group tickets. And thank God this was a friend of mine who stuck with me for the 48 hours it took for her to get the tickets for her son's hockey team.
What? So, first of all, I admire your persistence and generosity in helping your friend. In some way, that kind of friction story, the one that I opened with is just kind of blaming a specific leader for being clueless about their cone of friction. That's one of our on ramps, whatever. But your story, in some ways, to me, it's more about coordination neglect, we call it, which is when the people involved in running, designing the system don't get the handoffs between different people in different silos, correct?
That's right. And
that's a huge problem in one place that really happens, and that your listeners, if you're in the United States, you've experienced this, which is in healthcare, which is just a story of friction and fragmentation. Mm-hmm. And I mean, in the book, we talk about research by an amazing woman named Melissa Valentine. She studied the birth of a new, very well-funded cancer center, very well-funded. And they hired the best people. They bought all the new best equipment. They built beautiful buildings. And they focused on the little pieces and not how the pieces fit together. And the families, the patients, and so on, they suffered from the cancer tax, which meant that the family or the patient themselves had to do all the scheduling, had to weave together their whole treatment plan, and there was kind of nobody there to do it. And the healthcare system did come up with sort of a half-assed solution. Mm-hmm. But the interesting part about it, which was basically a single point of contact, was the one group that would not participate in the integrated solution were the oncologists, which is the most powerful people in the system.
Oh, no.
I didn't emphasize that in the book, or we didn't emphasize that in the book enough. But I mean, we're mostly talking about bad friction here, but sometimes it isn't the individual person to blame. Your story, every individual person meant well.
Yeah.
And we're probably competent within their little silo or little job. Yeah. The problem is the handoff.
So we're trying to fix it now. And here's the really interesting thing, because you say in the book, when you set out, you thought you were going to write a book about frictionless organizations.
Yes.
And that, I think, when you did the podcast, I think that's what I was picking up on most of.
Yeah.
But it turns out, like stress, you can't say friction is all bad.
No. And in fact, in some ways, I almost feel like I could write a whole nother book. And there's, I don't know, 35% of the book is about when friction is good.
Yeah.
But there's so many times when it's good. And I think that given the business you're in, my absolute favorite story in the book is when Jerry Seinfeld is interviewed by the Harvard Business Review, which sounds like the most bizarre thing on earth. And the editor of the Harvard Business Review, you know, your listeners will know the story that Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld, they wrote every episode. They fought like crazy with each other. I mean, you work with Larry David, you're going to fight. It's just the way it's going to be. and they struggle with every episode. And McKinsey, and so HBR asks, can McKinsey, the famous consulting firm, sometimes infamous, could they make the process more efficient? And Jerry Seinfeld says, who's McKinsey? They explain it's a consulting firm. And he says, are they funny? And they say no. And he said, I don't need them. The hard way is the right way. And I just everything, if you look at the academic research on creativity, and there's lots of times when friction is necessary, on creativity, I can't figure out any ways to do it without it being filled with failure. I mean, I don't know the percentage you would teach at Second City, but Seinfeld says he ends up keeping about 1 or 2% of the jokes that he tries. Is that, I don't know if that sounds right.
Yeah, I think we probably fall in line with like, you keep a version around 20 to 30%.
Okay.
And I think that jives more with behavioral science in terms of like Epley's work around, you know, how much are we getting it in the moment?
Right. I guess different things have a different sort of natural failure rate.
Yeah. Um,
but everything has a pretty high failure rate. And then you know, Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David, there's lots of evidence that the best teams fight in an atmosphere of mutual respect when they're doing creative work. And we can, it's just not a very efficient process. And my pal, Ed Catmull of Pixar fame, when I talk to Ed about efficiency, he just kind of glazes over. We never talked about efficiency. We just talked about getting it right. We just iterate and iterate until it was right.
Creativity desires constraints. And I think, you know, like you look at the Second City process, we put up an original show in 12 weeks and they're doing 8 shows a week and they're improvising in front of audiences and they have a day of rest and then they come back in the work camp. But it is, so there's this very specific process in which chaos is happening.
And so I
think too, let's use two examples from the book in terms of positive, one which needed friction, which is Google Glass.
So Google Glass, this is a great example of, so Google Glass essentially, and for your listeners, and I'm in Silicon Valley, so I make the mistake of people think,
assuming everyone knows every tech,
and they don't, and even in tech. So what Google did after, when they were so rich, it was ridiculous. And now they're having a little more financial discipline. They started something called Google X or X, which is a bunch of labs to do really creative breakthrough things. So their self-driving car startup has been spun out, but they not for any of the products have been very successful, to tell you the truth. So they have this largely unsuccessful R&D operation called Google X or X. And at one point, a team came up with these glasses called Google Glass that were sort of like a computer in your glass, and you'd look up in the corner and you'd see a little screen and you could adjust the thing. Sort of like a watch, but on your head, an Apple Watch on your head. And so the people in the lab, they were not ready to release it. And Sergey Brin, the co-founder and a guy who's worked with bazillions, he grabbed it out of the lab and threw it into the marketplace and made 5,000 of them and gave them to some of the most famous people in the world, had events in Paris and everything. And it turned out it was just an absolutely terrible, product. And at that point, and he pulled it off the market. He stopped using it. And that was a case where there wasn't enough friction. Some of the other cases that we talk about in the book that are more serious is Elizabeth Holmes. Elizabeth Holmes trying to put her fraudulent blood testing device on U.S. Army helicopters. It didn't have FDA approval, and she still was pushing to get them on there. We have two students who started a company called Sequel, which reinvented the tampon so it leaks less for more athletic women. They went through FDA approval. They just got FDA approval, and they also both graduated, unlike Elizabeth Holmes, so they're not dropouts. So sometimes friction's good.
Okay, and the other positive friction is this Jumbo supermarket story.
So let me sort of back up. So I've gotten really obsessed, is this a paper right here, with this research on savoring. There's some really cool research on savoring and how a hallmark of good mental health is that people slow down, they enjoy the good things in life, they anticipate how great they're going to be, and that's a good place to add friction, is to get people to slow down and sort of enjoy and think about what's going on. And so Jumbo Supermarkets, which is the largest supermarket chain in the Netherlands and in Holland. And there's actually a big movement in Holland out of concern for loneliness for older people who often are quite lonely, and so what they did is in one supermarket they experimented with a slow lane, and the idea of a slow lane is that somebody has a conversation with the supermarket clerk. And it works so well, they've scaled it up to 200 different Jumbo supermarkets. And that's exactly, it's like baking in inefficiency if you want to see what it is. So I thought that was a beautiful example of savoring.
So the curse of reading your book was, first of all, me sticking my nose into the group sales department at Second City, which I'm thankful for. I think that they needed the help. But I had just read about this on the plane as I was going to Orlando for a meeting. And then we're coming back the same day, and we're not that tight on time, but it's like getting a little tight on time. And I'm noticing that the very long line, even at TSA pre, where me and my boss were, the woman checking everyone in had to have a conversation.
No,
I'm so torn because I'm like, get me through this line.
No. That's this.
I know. I know that we're not asking for it at TSA. However, I will say I got up there. I enjoyed my little bit with her.
So it's interesting that, so one of my early academic studies with a woman named Anat Rafaeli, we looked at courtesy in 7-Eleven stores.
And we
tried to tie courtesy. So whether the clerk smiled, established eye contact, or said thank you, we tried to link courtesy to store sales, and it came out backward.
Yeah,
that the more sales they had, the less courteous they were. And then we did some analysis, and what we found was that the more sales that the line had, or the store had, and the longer the lines, the less courteous the clerk were, because in some ways just like your example, we expect the clerk, when it's not busy, it's just you might as well talk to them. What else do they have to do?
Yeah.
Maybe stock the shelves. But when it's really long, it's what we call busy store norms. And we would say that the problem is that person was applying slow store norms to a busy store. But that's a case where you're sort of adjusting the savoring, because it is not enjoyable to watch somebody have a long conversation when you just want to get me done. So
I don't know that I put this together or if you're explicit about it in the book, but is this – so you tell a story in the book about a big muckamuck at 7-Eleven thinking that everyone needs to smile more.
that's a case of what we call executive magnification. Yep. So the first on ramp is you're an oblivious executive, sort of like the senior dean or provost at Stanford who sent out this 1,266 word email, and you're oblivious to your cone of friction.
Yep.
And if you talk to senior executives, and unfortunately or fortunately, whatever, I know way too many of them, they're always talking about resistance to change. I want to have digital transformation. I want to have AI. I want to have design thinking in my organization, and the people are resisting it. But the one thing that they're pretty oblivious to is what we call executive magnification, that they have these weak signals and then people overamplify them, because it's sort of like a baboon troop. The way a baboon troop is that the average member looks up at the alpha male every 30 or 40 seconds. When you're in power, people devote a lot more attention to you than you do to them. And so this guy, this is a long time ago at 7-Eleven, 25, 30 years ago, before they sold it to a large Japanese company. And I think his name was Jody Thompson. And he went to a 7-Eleven store, and one clerk was nasty to him, and he went back to the office and complained. And they spent millions of dollars having a courtesy campaign. And this is this, and we were part of the research process because a good friend of mine in graduate school was in charge of it. And we came up with quite definitive evidence, especially my friend Larry Ford, that people don't go to 7-Eleven stores for courtesy. They want to get in and out fast. And if the clerk is really rude, they might notice it. But
I am there for eggs and for the rudeness.
Yeah. Eggs and so everybody wants. But if it's really slow and it's just you and the clerk, they might be more likely to have a conversation. Because this is customers as a source of entertainment, which is something.
Funny. So probably in my top 10 books that I got to read this year and then have a podcast interview is Lighty Klotz and Subtract.
Oh, the book right here. I'm waving it around.
Right there. You're waving it in front of me.
I love Lighty.
Yeah. And because you read that and you can't help but go, I'm just adding, aren't I? And
right.
I've told my wife about this, and she had to have she's directing one of the touring companies at Second City right now. She had to have a conversation with them about, you know, you adding more things is not going to get more laughs. And I'm like, oh, you should talk about Lighty Klotz's science. She goes, they don't care about the science. Fair point. But I think it's what's true is that is a really novel way of approaching change and corrections and experimentation is, what if we take away?
Yeah. So I mean, to sort of dig into that. So Lydie and I, like, we're friends, and we actually even wrote something about how universities need to do more subtraction together. So we're doing stuff together. But the stuff that Lydie and his co-authors at Virginia tend to focus on is this notion that we as human beings, we're just wired to solve problems naturally by addition rather than subtraction. We sort of have to be like your wife did. We have to be prompted to think about subtraction. It doesn't come naturally. And to do a yes and to you, I think you've heard this technique, yes and, before.
I have.
To do the yes and. One thing that makes it even worse are the kind of reward systems that many organizations have, including my own, Stanford University. But one of the problems is that people who add more stuff, who start programs, who build bigger fiefdoms, who add technologies, those are the people who tend to get rewarded, not the people who don't add anything in the first place, or the people who subtract. Because when you start subtracting, there's almost always somebody who it's, there's this precious thing and you're taking it away from them. And that might lead me to maybe the most important insight in the book. Speaking of comedians, so George Carlin had this great line, which is, my shit is stuff and your stuff is shit. So we might think that everybody else should get rid of their app, they should get rid of their meeting, they should get rid of their initiative, but my stuff. So you know, one of my stuff has been design thinking.
Yeah,
and it's just, you've been involved in the design thinking movement in various ways too, and that was sort of like a precious thing that I thought everybody should do and nobody should subtract. Well, the design thinking movement, I hate to say it, but it's sort of faded to some degree, at least in companies. And it's being subtracted, and maybe we all learned something from it, and it still is valuable. But I think we might have pushed people to add it too much for too many places, and that might be one of the reasons that, as with almost all management movements, it's faded a bit.
It's like too, agile.
Like agile. Yeah, Sam, we talk about agile in the book too, yeah.
I mean, I had an agile, you know, we get hired a lot to come in to companies, of course, and a lot of times what we're doing is they're saying, well, we do agile. I'm like, okay, we understand that, and we can be complimentary, or we do design thinking. Yeah, we understand that, we can be complimentary. And I remember my friend Neil Stevenson, who ran the IDEO here in Chicago for many years. I actually just had lunch with him today. I remember him cautioning me. He's like, never make improv a fad. Like, as long as you're not a fad, people keep buying.
Well, so I mean, let's talk about agile, because that gets us to, you know, probably one of my favorite phrases in the book, which I stole from a woman named Polly LeBaire, who used to sort of be a management guru, which is jargon monoxide.
Yep.
So this is sort of another cause of friction, where you got this challenge where people use language that's so complex, so incomprehensible or meaningless that it just sort of clogs up the system. And in the beginning, Agile was a really specific set of methods and philosophies about how to do software development, but now it's been applied to absolutely everything. And actually, I'm looking at here in the screen, and maybe you can get it to your listeners somehow or another. There's this Australian Agile coach, a guy's name is Craig Smith, and he gives this talk where he reviews 40 Agile methods in 40 minutes. And so I'm looking at it right now. I don't know what half this stuff is. The Vanguard method, XP, Deming, Kanban, Lean Startup, Hybrid, Agile, Large Scale Scrum, Scaled Agile Framework, Spotify Squadification. I don't know what Spotify.
Oh my God.
Mob Programming. So to me, it, we were actually talking before about Danny Kahneman et al.'s book Noise. Yep. Mm-hmm. And the way my summary of the book Noise, which we both read, is that noise is a random scatter of ideas, so that it sort of means nothing. And to me, I think Agile has devolved into a random scatter of ideas as a term. And that might have happened a little bit with design thinking too. And I guess if I'm lucky, it'll happen with friction too, because that's a sign that you have some impact at some point.
Sure. No. Yeah. They just got to come up with something new. It's funny. My son, who abandoned his corporate career, he was doing placement, but he mostly placed scrum masters. And I remember him saying, maybe I should put in on my LinkedIn that I'm a scrum master. And
a scrum master?
Scrum master.
Well, so, you know, it really is just, and back to the sort of arc of these things, One of the most successful design thinking movements that I was close to was one that was led by a woman you may know, Claudia Kochka, who was head of innovation at yep. Procter & Gamble. And yep. she really had, she had a huge effect in actually getting products like the Magic Eraser in the Mr. Clean group and spreading design thinking folks throughout the company, actually giving them roles in major businesses. And she never used the term design thinking. She just used the word innovation. And this was before the design thinking movement started taking yeah. off, because she said people would think it was a fad. So she just called it innovation.
Yeah.
She never used the word design thinking. And well, I think that's an interesting way to approach it.
Yeah. I mean, here's our dirty little secret is we're selling every one of these corporations play, and they would not buy it if I called it play. Like, who's going to buy play? And it's like, and there's so much, as you know, there's so much science around health outcomes and innovation and creativity and the need to play and the need to rest, and like, corporate America ain't buying. I mean, maybe one day, but certainly not now. There's so much cool stuff. You talked about Seinfeld. I had that in my notes. Here's the other thing I want you to talk about, because I don't know that I knew about the Simple Sabotage Field Manual. This is the OSS precursor to like the CIA, right?
Yes. So this is, who knows whether this stuff was actually done,
yeah.
This is the Simple Sabotage Field Manual. And this is the general idea to back up, that sometimes friction is weaponized. That's in such a way it's good for you and it's bad for other people. And in this case, this was sort of like for spies and for other allies of the U.S. government, you know, the British and so forth against the Nazis. And the idea was that there was a whole list of things that you were supposed to do, like ask for more and more meetings, more and more rules, keep asking questions, be obtuse. Oh, and then the other thing you should do is to try to promote the people who are incompetent and slow things down and screw things up, and try to demote and fire the competent people. And so it's free online. People don't have to buy it. It's this OSS Simple Sabotage Field Manual. And the idea was to sort of clog up the system. And unfortunately, to go to corporate America, and also other corporations, a lot of them have this incentive to make it really easy for us to sign up for, and the example I use in the book is the New York Times, because the New York Times wrote an article criticizing Amazon for how hard it was to get rid of their Prime account. And somebody else wrote an article saying how hard it was to get rid of their New York Times subscription.
Yeah.
And I tried that with FT. I could not believe Financial Times, how many steps I had to go through to cancel my Financial Times subscription. And just as a footnote to this, there is a business case for not weaponizing friction against consumers. And we use the example of Netflix.
Yeah.
Because in Netflix, and this was about 2005 or 2006, there was a lot of concern in the company. And this came from Patty McCord, who was then basically head of HR, and also a friend of mine, former student of mine, Eric Colson, who was a senior algorithm type guy. And they were embarrassed because it was so hard to cancel your Netflix subscription. And they talked Reed Hastings into making it really easy. And it's so easy that I almost canceled it accidentally while I was testing out when I was doing the book. It's just one button. And Eric Colson had a really interesting point about this. He said, yes, in the short term, you make more money if it's impossible for people to cancel things that are driving them crazy. That's how gym membership works. Everybody signs up the gyms at the beginning of the year, and it's impossible to cancel your subscription. But Eric made this argument, and so did Patty, that one of the reasons that Netflix has been so successful over the long term is it's really easy to cancel. So they have really great data about customer dissatisfaction. So as soon as people are unhappy, they cancel. And since it's frictionless almost to cancel, that they know when it's time to make adjustments. So they believe that in addition to this being something they're less embarrassed to talk to their relatives about, I think that's what drove them initially. So Eric, who does the algorithmic stuff and does different A-B testing, from an A-B testing standpoint, you learn more quickly when it's easier for people to cancel. So it's another yes and situation.
Yeah, that, you know, that reminds me here. So for years, a guy named Bill Wirtz owned the Chicago Blackhawks, and he would not allow the games to be televised. Only franchise that would do it. He's like, if they're getting it for free, they're not going to come in. So he dies. His son Rocky takes over. He immediately has them televised, and they win 3 Stanley Cup championships. It's, you know, and there's so many examples of that. I don't know if I ever told you this story. I was working. I'm not going to go into all the details, but we're at the Aspertus Institute of Jewish Learning, and we're doing a set of workshops. And we're doing an exercise called Follow the Follower. And the exercise in this particular version was the teacher told one person in the class they were the leader, and everyone was to just silently walk around the room, do kind of like a spacewalk. And then that person who was the leader and no one else knows, they need to find someone non-verbally and hand off leadership. And that person then has to take it and do the same.
Oh, that's so cool.
Well, and what was interesting is Hal Lewis, the director of Spertus, turns to me and goes, "You're doing Peter Drucker." And I'm like, "Great, who's Peter Drucker? This is so," and you quote Drucker, but you know, he's talking about like, this is this idea of shared leadership, this idea of knowledge workers and all that. And one of the things that you talk about in the book that has been a huge source of conversation between my wife and I and others here is hierarchies. And the idea that I know we're pretty flat here,
right?
And that often is really great for creativity, but sometimes it's really not. And I think from what I'm reading that you're talking about, and I've got this book on ethics that I'm reading right now, that hierarchy, you can't get rid of hierarchies. It's a little bit like air.
Yeah. Well, that, so to, you know, to riff off that, and I had this argument a little bit with somebody just yesterday. It is that there's no way I can figure out, so as an organizational theorist, for organizations of any size, how to just organize them, how to structure them without having different levels of power, without having some specialization, without having some rules or norms. I mean, baboon troops, they have different norms. And some baboon troops are nastier than other baboon troops. Robert Sapolsky, who follows baboon troops, can show you that in some that there's not as much sort of beating up of the young adolescent males as other ones. And I don't know any way to organize a system. And in fact, two of my colleagues, Deb Grunfeld, and I'm trying to remember the other co-author, they did a general review of research on hierarchy. And essentially, they'll show you that even in systems that claim to have no hierarchy, there's almost always a hierarchy. And then the other thing is, when you tell people in groups, there will be no hierarchy. So leaderless groups, they have all sorts of friction till they figure out who's in charge. So I can't. And the argument we make is, we're not saying that people should be authoritarian and nasty. Worse, you know, there are many leaders who are benevolent and caring and share power and so forth, that's important. And to do a yes and, one the thing that I think great leaders do, and this is stealing research from Lindy Greer. She's a professor at University of Michigan. She's done all these studies that show that what the best leaders do is, I guess, because I'm talking to you, I'm yes-anding like crazy. They exercise authority and they let go of it. So this idea, she describes it, of flexing the hierarchy. What great leaders do is they say, "Let's brainstorm. Let's have everybody do it their own way for a couple of months or a couple of years and see who wins." But then they will sort of activate the hierarchy to take charge. And I think that academics, you talk about ethics, who study conflict, and boy, are we in a time of international conflict now, and conflict within organizations, that some. Somebody who has a stronger authority is one of the only ways sometimes to stop people from fighting. And the way Lindy would do it in her like studies, she did some case studies of 10 startup CEOs. And what the best ones would do, one of the times they would intervene, is when people would get mired in endless stupid conflict. And they'd say, "We're going to make a decision. I'm sorry you don't like it. We've got to ship the product. Let's go."
Yeah,
or we've got to end the meeting. Let's stop fighting and go to work.
I think the important thing there is understanding that as human beings, you know, we resist change. We don't like change. We like our patterns, and that nothing is static, and everything has context. And so you've got to have. And again, we talked about this with creativity. It desires constraints. It needs that. If we're, you know, no one leaves the theater saying, "I wish that play were longer." it doesn't happen.
Yeah. So. Although, no, it is interesting though. Some things are so well done that sometimes I wish that they were longer too. So I've seen some great 3-hour movies. I have
too, but you don't say it should have been 7 hours.
No, you're right. Okay, fair enough.
All right. I was on the phone the other day with a friend of mine who she had worked for decades at this one organization. She left. And she's at this new place. And I did, because, you know, she's got a very sunny Instagram profile. And I'm like, how's the new gig? And she, it was the saddest response. It was just sort of like, no, it's not my people, but, you know, I need the money kind of thing. Oh. And you talk about you speaking at this law firm and one of the partners coming up to you afterwards and telling you about this, like, group he started at the firm called the Grass is Browner Club.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I told her that story, but please tell us that story.
Okay, so I'll name the law firm. I was a speaker. Right. It was King & Spalding, yes. Huge law firm. And so I'm at a partner retreat, and I gave a talk about scaling, but, you know, it's after Reed's words, and we're just all sort of talking about stuff. And one of the general argument I make about leading organizational change, and I actually first heard this from David Kelly at IDEO, and I eventually followed the D School, that when people would complain, he would say, everywhere you go, it's going to be difficult and messy. If you can find a place where things are perfect, go there. But I don't think that place exists. And there are some places that are better than other. But this idea that life's going to be beautiful and organized and you're never going to need to struggle, well, I think that's one of the things that people like me who write books sometimes make the claim, and I should stop even saying that ever. Because, you know, it's the classic thing, and even I'm going to get in trouble with this, one of my favorite books ever is Creativity Incorporated by Ed Catmull about Pixar. And one of the things people said at Pixar was, wow, that sounds like a great organization. I wish I worked there. So that was one of the, and so what happened to King & Spalding was that at this retreat of 300 or 400 partners of this law firm, they had affinity groups. Like, they had the gay lawyers. They had the lawyers who went to Harvard. I mean, they had the black lawyers. They had, like, the little groups who would sort of meet. And one of the groups was the Grasses Browner Club. And the Grasses Browner Club are people who left King & Spalding for another law firm. And it was even worse, so they came back.
Yeah.
And to me, that was sort of a lesson that sometimes life is messy. And that's why, I mean, the very ending three paragraphs or whatever of the book, I talk especially about a woman named Clara Shai. She's an amazing woman, wrote a bestseller on the Facebook generation before she was 30. She's now CEO of AI at Salesforce. And Clara says when she's leading large scale change, she starts out by telling people that life is messy. But Clara is a very rational person. I love how Clara handles this. She does what she calls separation of concerns, because she was the number one student in computer science at Stanford. She's like freaking brilliant. Oh. And so she says, I got one group whose job it is to just go ahead with the plan. And then I have the group whose job it is to deal with the messes. So I love that idea that your job, you're the messy people and you're the neat people. Uh-huh. So you kind of need both in life. So I thought that was a cool solution.
I've been doing a thing at my keynotes where I say to the audience, raise your hand if you ever worked at a place you would say is truly functional. I have only had one audience where anyone rose a hand.
You know, I would raise half a hand now, because I've been at Stanford 40 years. That's not functional. No, no. I'm sort of looking at the door a little bit. But the last 3 or 4 years, I've had a department chair. I'll use her name's Pam Hines.
Yeah.
That Stanford has many dysfunctions. All you have to do is read the press about all the little troubles we have. But to Pam Hines' credit, she is so good. She's the best boss I've ever had. She is so good. I mean, for example, you know, since I am interested in friction, she has made clear to the staff that it's their job to make things easier on students and faculty so they can focus on their teaching, research, and learning. And
I mean it's
not perfect, but it's better anywhere else at Stanford than I know right now. Unbelievable, and she has actual management skill, which is rare in academia. So.
Yeah, and I should write about this more because I really people don't talk enough about this, and I think it's very true, which is we don't solve these problems enterprise wide. That's impossible. We don't solve them individual by individual. We can do team by team.
You can do team by team, and I would. I'm having so much fun saying yes and to you. I can't believe. when these things are most functional, I think they're top down and they're bottom up. And we have the case of AstraZeneca in the book, where if their calculation is right, but they claim they reduce 2 million hours of people waste by doing everything from doing top down changes to make it really hard to add a lot of people when you CC'd an email. I thought that was pretty good. To local changes in South America, or even one country, Colombia, where they got rid of sort of inefficient processes, but there were six processes and they cut it to one. When that was top down and bottom up, and I think in the best organizations, and I don't want to be too idealistic, but people tend to see themselves as friction fixers and to be aware of trying to be trustees of others' time. So, and there's some organizations are better at that than others.
Yep. All right. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a thank you because story. But before we do that, I don't think I hate anything as much as I hate buying a car. I prefer my colonoscopy.
Me too.
I prefer the dentist, minor surgery. It is. And I have done the last time I did this. I literally looked at the person and I go, I'm going to plead with you. I'm in a very bad place right now. I'm dealing with a family health issue. And this is all true. And I was I just need to not let's just agree on the price. I don't want to go back and find out that it was something else. I'm can you just I just want honesty. I just want. And of course I got screwed. And they did not agree. And then I got in all these hassles. You give a reason, I think, in the book why that might be.
There's a lot of reasons, but one cause. If we sort of back up, so one of the things that causes leaders in people in organizations to be oblivious, in this case to customers' experience, is they have, and this is one of the definitions of privilege, is the absence of inconvenience that the little people like you and me have to go through when they buy a car. Uh-huh. So General Motors has had this program, and I fact-checked this was true up till 2022, and I think it still exists. They had this program where actually quite down to a lower level than you would expect, and it depends how senior and executive you were and in what era, but somewhere between every 3 and 6 months, you get a free car. Or you get a car that doesn't cost a couple hundred dollars a month, but you can't, there's no negotiation there. And what happens is you pick the car. I guess if you're Mary Barra, the CEO, you get to get a Corvette or something like that. But if you're a regular Joe, you get to get, maybe something like a Bolt or something. And they give it to you. You drive it for 6 months and then, they give you another car. And the guy that I fact checked this with, who had just left as an executive just a couple of years ago, he said it's even worse than that. That they actually have, you can gas up your car and get it serviced in the larger facilities, or you can take it to one of the larger facilities if one's far away. And so if you think about that, you're even protected from gas prices or maintenance. So literally it's protected from the inconvenience. And I do think that that's one of the many causes why buying a car is so inconvenient and so difficult. There might be other reasons as well.
So the reason we're burdened by all this friction is because it's a frictionless experience for the executives.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, and look, I, you know, you know that anytime, I mean, Dr. Keltner's work around the automobiles and status and you know, people in the nicer cars tend to run the stop signs more than other
right,
people.
Right, yeah.
Power,
feeling powerful is not necessarily good for you. Right. But one thing I would add is that it is not, the Dr. Keltner stuff, it is not guaranteed you will behave that way.
Yes.
There are some leaders who actually don't fall prey to that. And there's some interesting research by my colleague, Frank Flynn at Stanford. It turns out that some of the leaders who are most likely to be the best leaders and not to fall prey to what we call power poisoning,
yep,
guilt. So being Jewish and being raised as a good old-fashioned guilty family, it turns out that guilty people are more likely,
yeah,
to be chosen to be in power, and they're more likely to be better leaders because they feel so guilty they don't want to exploit people. So that's one of the solutions is get like a guilt-ridden, you know, sort of leader.
So this is interesting. When I was just down in Orlando with my boss, who's the CEO of the company, I'm name check him, Ed Wells, and we had this incident where our cab pulled up to the location we're having our meeting, and the credit card thing wouldn't work, and uh-huh, it was blank, and the guy calls in to the dispatch, and they're not being helpful, and he's like, "Look, you guys can just go, you know, it's fine." And Ed's like, I'm not going to stiff you. We didn't have any cash. He's like, I see a bank over there. So he went to the bank, went to the ATM, paid the guy, and we got out. I just turned to Ed. I go, "You're the only CEO in America that would have done that." And I'm not sure I would have done it. And one of the things about, I quite honestly, I don't think I've ever had an ethical boss.
I might have had a couple of them.
You might have had a couple, maybe. I've told the story a bunch because I was like, you could kind of know, like, this is like the behavior of the person who's up at top, is that they took the time because they recognize this is, I don't know where this person's, you know, at. And, you know, it was really nice. And I don't know, man. I think that, you don't mention Dunning-Kroger in the book.
No, Dunning-Kroger. Yeah, but yeah, what is it? That the more incompetent you are at something, the better you think you are at it, or something.
The more confidence you have, the less probably capability of actually doing the thing. Power does blind you, and I know this in the sense of like I have a lot of status in the position I'm in. Uh-huh. So when I have to have a conversation with someone where I want their honesty, I don't stay behind my desk. I have two chairs that are next to each other. And there's little things you can do. That's, I guess, a nudge.
One of the things. So my wife, who ran two big organizations. She was managing partner of a large law firm. That was one of the things that led me to write the no asshole rule, since there's a lot of asshole management in law firms.
Yep.
And then she was CEO of the Girl Scouts of Northern California, much different population. But in both organizations, both much different organizations. But one of the things that she always did, which to me takes an incredibly thick skin, is that in many organizations, there's the person who talks a lot and gossips a lot.
Yeah.
And complains a lot. She would seek out that person and try to become friends with that person because even though she said it would sometimes be hard to take, and this is a psychological safety thing, she tried to make it safe for that person to complain and give her the bad news and everything. And the other thing about it, she said, which is, you know, a little bit more self-serving, she said, you know, people who are central in gossip networks, if you can get in there, you sometimes can make the gossip a little better than worse for yourself. So I thought that was a pretty good strategy that to use, although I'm not sure I could do it myself. So
no, anyway. I know it's hard. You know, I said this to someone today that one tactic I wish I had throughout my career was knowing to shut up. And it's really like that took a long time. And that's, again, one of those things, like, people will tell you things if you are just quiet and let them tell you things instead of adding in all your stuff, if that's the point of the exercise.
Yeah, so. I think Elon Musk, there's a book by Dan Lyons, STF. to you.
I had Dan on the podcast.
I blurred that book. I love that book. And I think that's the book that Elon Musk needs to read right now.
Yes, send that to Elon for him not to read. All right. So for guests who've been on before and have already done a yes and story, we asked for a thank you because story. You and I kind of went back and forth on what that meant. And it turns out it's a really incredible technique for staying inside a difficult conversation. So do you have a thank you because story for us?
Oh, I have so many thank you because, I just live around people who argue with me and convince me I'm wrong. But one of the thank you because stories that I would have is that when it comes to the friction fixing thing, if I was going to fault myself, I'm a little bit too impatient and not understanding of people who don't do it as fast as I think they should. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of reasons why people don't get people. And I'm talking about getting rid of bad friction, why people go slowly when I think they should go fast. And an example of this, and I learned this from, this is my favorite example of friction fixing in the book. So there's a nonprofit in Michigan called Sevilla. Mm-hmm. And it was founded by a guy named Michael Brennan, who I met at the Stanford Design School when he was there on a little sabbatical. And they were obsessed with the fact that there was a form that was filled out by 2.5 million Michiganders a year to get benefits, food, extra income, shelter, medical care, 2.5 million residents a year, 1,000 questions, 42 pages long. The classic stupid question was, when was your child conceived? Which was asked of everybody, even people who didn't have children. Yeah. And just this terrible form. And actually, Michael Brennan and his team got them to come up with a new form that's 80% shorter. People make far fewer mistakes. There's far fewer visits to the office far fewer forms rejected. It's kind of an amazing transition. But one of the reasons they were successful, Adam Selzer, who's one of the co-founders, he said, one of the reasons we were successful is, he said, although I'm a naturally impatient person, we did all these things to slow down. First of all, to bring the bureaucrats on board. So they actually had the top four or five people fill out the form, and only one of them had ever filled out the form before. And the head of the agency, his name I think is Terry Brewer, he only got to page 8, and he realized there was a problem. So they came on board, and then when they had a prototype, as Adam Seltzer told me, there were 1,700 pages of rules we had to comply with before we could implement the form. So there, this idea that sometimes being patient and going really slow when you're doing something complicated, that's something that I'm trying to thank people for. And I'm trying to be patient and slow down when things are hard. And one thing, and this isn't in the book, I'll end with this, since the book came out, this just came out, it was one of those academic studies. They did brain scans, fMRIs or something like that. So there's some new research that shows that people have higher IQs. Yes, they make simple decisions and solve simple problems more quickly. But people who are smarter, they solve complex problems more slowly because they take the time to figure out the complexity, and they're more often to be right. So, and this is back to, good versus bad friction, yeah. I guess. And I think that's one reason that towards the end of this book project, and since the book is done, I've gotten more enamored about when things ought to be slow, both because we make better decisions and because it's just better for our minds, too.
I mean, having mentioned Kahneman, that feels like system one, system two.
Yes.
And one of the things, if you think about what an improviser is doing who has no script, is the need to, you're not a good improviser if you're pre-writing. So you really do have to listen to what the person's saying and then just come out and say whatever, first thought, best thought. But it is that sort of back and forth, system one, system two, system one, system two. And I think one of the reasons all these superstars come out of Second City, it's not because they've been the same casting director forever. It's they're all trained in this methodology.
Ooh, well, that's really interesting. Yeah. I mean, you are a sophisticated person about bringing the behavioral science to real life, and yeah, to me, that's just system one, system two. Although, I mean, I love Danny Kahneman's work, but one of the things that Kahneman's one of the first people to talk about is he's such a rational person. He sometimes forgets it's about emotion. I've heard him say that before. And there's other emotional reasons. One other reason for friction, positive friction to sort of end with, which I've really gotten interested in, is that there's all this evidence, with the Supreme song, You Can't Hurry Love, yep. that to develop deep personal relationships with it in a duo and a team that it takes a while to do that, to have a really, really great team. It tends to be people who worked together before on different sorts of projects and got to know each other. Yeah. So there's some things that are hard to make efficient.
The book is called The Friction Project. Bob Sutton, thank you for coming on the pod again.
Oh, it's really fun.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox The Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.